This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Luke Jones. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. It's 3 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. This time on BBC OS Conversations, we bring together people to share their experiences of the war. At dawn on the 24th of February 2022, Ukrainians were woken by sirens and the sound of explosions as Russia launched missile strikes across the country. 3 years after the start of the full-scale invasion, we bring together Ukrainians, hear from refugees, and women rebuilding to the sound of rave.
You have like a Dieterich plane, you have like destroyed buildings, and you have people who are volunteers, and instead of dancing under the music of the DJ, they're actually building the house or cleaning up the debris.
At a summit in Germany last weekend, the US Vice President J.D. Vance told a delegation of European leaders that there's a new sheriff in town. This week, that new sheriff, President Donald Trump, turned his attention to Ukraine. On Tuesday, US and Russian officials held face-to-face talks without Ukraine. Then, the US president appeared to blame Ukraine for starting the war. In response, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said President Trump was living in a disinformation space. The US president subsequently called President Zelensky a dictator and said Russia holds the cards in peace negotiations. Just to be clear, the Ukrainian president was democratically elected in 2019, and elections in the country are suspended because of martial law brought in at the start of the war. As we record this programme, on Friday lunchtime, it's not certain how any of this diplomacy, if that is the right word, will play out. What we can do is get a sense of what life is like in Ukraine by catching up with some Ukrainians living under the constant threat of Russian missile and drone attacks. We brought together three people who we first met on this programme shortly after the full-scale invasion of the country in 2022. Daniel is an artist, Ludmila is a humanitarian worker, and Sasha works in communications. She had to leave Western Ukraine when Russia invaded.
Our cities is bombed, destroyed to the ground. Our friends, relatives are dying every day. And at the same time, some level of civilian life exists parallel to the war hostilities. And it sounds a little bit absurd, and it feels a little bit absurd. So we woke up in the morning after every night air raid alarm. We woke up and we have to go at work. We have to take our children to kindergartens or schools or whatever. Our children have to go to schools and then study in the basements when the alarm goes off again. So it's terrible. At the same time, you get used to this.
This past 3 years, I feel like I've changed a lot as a person. And I see that a lot of people around me also, they changed completely. Mm-hmm. They kind of lost this sparkle that they had before. And I can say this about myself too. But not only in the dark way, also in the positive way, I feel like we became stronger since the beginning of full-scale invasion. Probably most of us rebuilt themselves during this time because this whole situation helped for me personally to find new ways how to help other people, how to become useful. I became way more easier to be on, like, if you need me, I will come immediately. Because now, and I feel more active about being helpful to someone who needs help.
We started to have a special kind of humor, which for us is like survival humor, you know. So, of course, we are living in survival mode, but it helps us to stay stronger. Every day, almost every night, the Shaheds and the ballistic rockets, missiles are flying over my building. So almost every night we have to go down to the basement, because we don't know if we have a chance to have a next day, you know.
Yeah. Is there a moment where any of you can not think about the war?
We, of course, have some moments when we are meeting with friends and trying not to think and talk about the situation, because when you live in this condition for every day, you don't want to talk about it more because you have this sort of experience by hearing explosions. So this is something that you cannot control. So when you can control the narrative of your communication, you don't want to talk about it. And when we have some sort of meetings, we have a rule not to talk about it, and especially about the politics stuff. We're just trying to talk about some sort of bright moments.
Culture helps immensely when you go to some cinema or exhibition. I recently visited the play Servant of Two Masters in one of the Kyiv theaters, and it was very funny. And I didn't remember for the last time I was laughing out loud in the theater. So there are moments when you think that you live in a pre-full invasion life, but of course it comes back all the time. That's why we are not totally mental yet.
So I would say that the war completely permeates our lives. Even when we meet with the friends or, yeah, with the family, so we still talk about the war, about the supporting air force defense or military units that we are helping. But at the same time, we talk about the value of life and its fragility, because we understand that, like, every moment can be the last one. So we began to tell each other more often about that we love each other. And we began to talk better about, like, with each other. And we became to take care more for each other. And, like, to keep, you know, the fragility of life and our relationships, we keep more, like, care more about it, you know. So it's very valuable for us to have each other.
If I may, I wanted to add that the relationship changed a lot, especially when there are a lot of my friends who either went to the army, who are fighting right now, or their girlfriends or wives are my friends. So it's always difficult to talk with us. Some of my friends left Ukraine. They now live in Europe, and we almost lost the connection because we have absolutely different we have basically nothing to talk about, even if we were friends for more than 10 years before this. It's very difficult to communicate with a person who lives in peaceful Europe, though they sometimes come back and we, like, compare notes, you know. The other side of this broken communication, I would say, it's that everyone basically has a different experience in life. Someone lost relatives, someone lost their home. Some, like you guys from Luhansk, basically can't come back to your native city, because I can't comprehend what you feel when you know that your native city is occupied. And there are a lot of different gradations of these difficulties. So the communications became both a lot of harder, and at the same time, it became more sincere, you know, because we, as Lyudmila said, we all feel that we don't have, every day could be the last day. So we, like, we talk a lot more sincerely with each other, especially in the tight-knit circle of close friends and family.
When you say you live every day like it could be your last day, I mean, do you really mean that?
Yeah, but, you know, like, we have... 2 or 3 days ago in Kyiv, we had a ballistic missile in the morning, and it could hit anywhere, literally anywhere. So, yes.
And you know that I'm thinking right now that the funeral started to be, like, often part of our lives. And like, with our friends, we started to meet often on the funerals than, like, just like this, to have some bright moment, you know. But we don't have time to grieve, because it has happened, like, so often in such large amount, so we don't have time to grieve individually for every event, you know. So it's very hard to think about that one moment you have to go to the funeral, other moment you have to do your job, and you have to keep going, to keep moving your life, to keep be happy from the children's laugh, and you have to keep trying to find some bright moments. So for me, for example, the children of my community is very valuable. And I think that we started to value our children more since the beginning of the war, because right now we understand that Russia kills a lot of children, and this is our precious children that can die every moment. So we have to value them so much, even more than before. I can't, like, it's very difficult to explain that the child himself is innocent. He did nothing wrong. But this aggression, it's very difficult to explain to the child.
I'd be keen to know from all of you how these last 3 years have affected how you see your future, how it's changed your hopes and aspirations and dreams, if it has.
I simply stopped dreaming, you know. This is the point. And when you are living in the war, I don't have dreams anymore. Like, I had dreams before to travel, to have some happy moments. But now I'm not sure that it is possible, you know. So I'm simply dreaming on this scale of the war, you know, of something practical. But I don't have any dreams over the when the war will stop, you know, because we don't know actually if it is possible.
I agree. I wanted to say that I'm also not planning my future anymore. Like, it's hard to plan something ahead of a month, for example. Like, I'm afraid to plan something on this long. But before the full-scale invasion, it was pretty normal, for example, to plan a trip. Like, for example, I will fly somewhere during the summertime. But now I will not allow myself to say this sort of words because I'm afraid to think about something ahead. We are just living in the moment, I guess, all of us. Like, today is the day. We don't know what is going to happen tomorrow. The rocket can hit your building, your house, and that's all. So you're not thinking about tomorrow even. Like, you're just in the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you both. It's like we are planning basically day to day. We have like this joke with our friends that we are being optimistic if we plan something on Monday to Friday. It's our optimistic side is talking. Before the war, we traveled a lot. We used to travel like 2-3 times a year somewhere in Europe or Southeast Asia. And now we have a lot of pictures. And now when I look at them, it feels like it's not my life. It was from some kind of movie or some other person's life. You know, this strange effect of a war that your past, you have no future. You feel that you don't have any future, and your past feels like it's not yours anymore. It was just a very good movie.
I actually think that I have one dream. I want to see my home in Lugansk, and I want to have possibility to visit Crimea, because all my summers of childhood and youth were spending there with my grandmother, because my parents are from Crimea. So I lost Lugansk and Crimea. So this is hard for me. And I really dream to swim in the Black Sea and to breathe those sea wind, you know. This is the real dream.
Ludmila, Sasha and Daniel giving us their insight into the last 3 years of war in Ukraine. I'm Luke Jones and this is BBC OS Conversations from the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The Ukrainian government says that some 43,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in the conflict over the past 3 years. The United Nations estimates that 12,400 civilians have lost their lives. We also mentioned in our last conversation the many areas of Ukraine under Russian occupation, including Crimea, that Russia annexed back in 2014, and that many Ukrainians have been forced from their homes as a result. And while more than 3 million people have been displaced to other parts of the country, 6.7 million Ukrainians are living abroad as refugees. We caught up with two of them. Alona moved to the UK in 2022, shortly after the war started, and Sophia moved from the invaded Donbass region to Kyiv, then to Poland, and then finally to the UK.
My parents really didn't want to leave because I was born in Luhansk. It's the city in Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, and we already fled the occupation in 2014. That's when we moved to Kyiv. So for my family, it was really hard to kind of flee Russia for the second time. It was really morally difficult for my mom that we have to run away again and to be refugees again.
How have the past 3 years been for the three of you, seeing it and hearing about, I'm sure, terrible things happening at home and maybe involving family and friends as well?
We try to visit Ukraine quite often, like maybe twice a year, because my dad is in Kyiv. So you always go back and you hear all the air sirens and the rockets. So you know that the war is still going on. And it's crazy to think that it's been 3 years. But at the same time, it does feel like it's been a long time. Like my life has changed significantly. And I can definitely see that the person who I was in January 2022 and the person that I am right now are completely different. It's just crazy to think that it's been 3 years and people are still dying and all the atrocities are still happening.
I agree with Sophia. It's very hard to understand and comprehend all the situation. I also try to go back to Ukraine a few times, and in 2024, in July, Russia launched a missile in Ukrainian Hochmadid. It is like child's hospital, so this the biggest in Ukraine, where the hardest surgeries are conducted. And at that moment, I was around that, and it was so terrifying. I was so scared. I thought that I would die. And then when I came back to the UK, I still have dreams about that day, you know, like your brain cannot forget. So, and I can just wake up during the night having the dream about like how Russian missile is falling on my head, despite being in safe place.
If you listen to Donald Trump, you might think that there is some negotiated settlement to end the war way off, not in the not too distant future. What do you make of it?
As a person from Lugansk, which is currently occupied, for me, it's a really sensitive issue that, you know, I spend a lot of my time growing up in Lugansk, but also we spent a lot of time in Crimea. So for me, I don't imagine Ukraine without these territories. And I just, all the talks about, you know, giving up these territories in change for peace, like, I understand where people come from when they talk about this, but for me, I think there couldn't be any peace without all the territories and all the people who are still there, because we can't just generally say that, you know, people in the occupied territories are pro-Russian, because it's simply not true. And a lot of those people are elderly people who can't leave because they just can't physically. So all these peace negotiations with the territory, with the Ukrainian territory, just, you know, dividing Ukraine will not get us anywhere, in my opinion.
And if people say that just give up territories to keep places safe, yes, I also understand where it comes from, but it will never be enough for them. They will always want to have more territories because it's like empire.
Alona and Sophia, both now in the UK. For our final conversation, we're going to hear from two people who've been part of a volunteer effort to rebuild homes destroyed by Russian forces. But this is a volunteer project with a difference. It's run by Ukrainian youth organisation Repair Together that run cleanup raves, where they invite DJs to play music as volunteers and locals work together to restore areas liberated from Russian occupation. We brought together Sasha and Darka from the organisation to explain more.
the way it looks like, you have like a detroit plane, you have like destroyed buildings that need restoration, and you have people who are volunteers, and instead of dancing under the music of the DJ, they're actually building the house or cleaning up the debris after the destroyed house. But it also was a lot of different kinds of it, because a rave every week was sometimes a little bit too much, especially at the beginning of full-scale invasion. So there was, yes, there was a jazz music, there was a different kind of like cultural activity, just like Ukrainian traditional dances, I remember, or some famous artists. Like my favorite one was a concert of Unuka. It's a famous Ukrainian artist who combines, you know, electronic music with kind of like Ukrainian traditional folk instruments. And basically, like, she was standing there in front of the rain and all of the volunteers were trying to do some work, and she was doing this folk music with electronic. Like, the formats have been very just designed based on that luck and based on having something good coming out of it.
What is important, I think, about Repair Together's success, if we may call it, like the fact that we still exist, I'd consider that a success. Like, and we're also building houses from scratch while having literally no experience in that. And like, these are good houses. So, I mean, I think that's enough for me to be satisfied with our activities. You were just doing what you could with the resources that you had. And like, two out of four co-founders of Repair Together, they were DJs themselves. So, you know, that's why it all kicked off with the Rave Talakas, because they just had decks. They knew how to play music and they were like, okay, like, then we'll be playing today first. And then only after that, all of the famous singers and like, and even foreign DJs were coming, but first it just were like the exact organizers team people who were DJs and who could play, so they played. Coming back to the like the secret of why do we last for that long, I guess, is that we choose the community building as our main function, not only rebuilding houses or villages, but building a community of people who like to volunteer and who value each other and being a part of this Repair Together volunteer team.
Yes, I would also add that another big point, for instance, for people like me, was seeing the international people involved, having this community of international volunteers coming over and being part of this. Because in Ukraine, you very often can feel excluded, let's call it this way. The things that are happening there don't happen anywhere else in Europe or the US. So I think seeing there and being able to work with them on the same terms and doing things together was a big part for many volunteers as well.
How does the future look for your project? I mean, both in terms of your ability to keep doing what you're doing, but also, you know, as we get to this third anniversary of the war, how the future looks like on a sort of global sense. You know, we've had lots of discussions, as I'm sure you'll be across, between the US and Russia and Ukraine about how this war might come to a negotiated end.
Darka, do you want to say something?
Oh, yeah, so much. yes. I just learned that you don't need to think about the future. You just have to do whatever you can at the moment. I think that was my main lesson in the past 3 years, because then you just end up flexing the whole time to other people's terms or the circumstances around you, and you just end up wasting your time. So the future of the organization and of all of us are just going to be doing, you know, what we do. And as Sasha rightfully said before, like, our luck very quickly transferred into very, very, very hard work that has been going on, you know, like, since the beginning. So we do believe that because of the community that we have and because of all of the, I don't know, like, literally belief of the every single person in the organization in the future of it, we can get out of this together and we can power through and build even more fantastic projects outside of all of the geopolitical circumstances that are happening at the moment.
After all, in the end of the day, you may read all of the news, and that will, of course, give you some pessimist approach to the whole situation, but after that you know some simple facts. For example, Repair Together is right now rebuilding 13 houses from scratch, and they're all on different stages of construction. It means that there are 13 families whose house has been completely destroyed by Russians and who we've promised that we're gonna rebuild their homes. So we'll always have something to do with all of these amazing people that are our community. My last rule is to go to sleep before Trump wakes up. Like, I went to sleep with an awful mood because I've read something that he said. I'm sorry. Yeah, so that's a new rule.
You do what you need to do. That was Sasha and Darker from Repair Together. Thank you to them and to all of our guests this week. I'm Luke Jones, and you've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme. Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.